This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic. Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest.
If no, you that's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
Do you ever dream of being your own boss? Like, would you think about kickstarting your own business? Because the stats are pretty grim. Like, for a few reasons, young people are not launching into their entrepreneurial big dog futures. So what is the consequence of that and how do we turn it around? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, we're going to hear from some of those who are giving it a go.
I've pretty much sacrificed like the glory days of my whole entire like 20s because I'm working 12-hour days.
Yeah, I want to hear from you as well. If you're under 30, if you're thinking about launching a small business, if you've tried and hasn't really turned out how you would have liked, tell me about that experience. Would you recommend 0439757555? Also, want to hear what kind of businesses you're all CEOing. Tell me. Later, that is coming up. First, though,
Hack.
Actress Rebel Wilson has successfully defended a defamation case
on Triple J.
Yeah, a saga that's been dragging for years involving celebrity Rebel Wilson has drawn to a close, it appears. A high-profile defamation case brought against Rebel from an actor who was starring in a production that Rebel Wilson was directing. Now, we heard a bit from the evidence in this trial a few months ago, but today there was a bit of a decision. So let's find out more with the ABC's Lydia Feng, who's been in court. Hey, Lydia, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
What happened in court this afternoon? What did the judge decide?
So Justice Elizabeth Raper handed down her judgment at the Federal Court in Sydney today. It was very brief. We were there at 2:15. By 10 minutes, I would say it was all over.
Wow.
And basically cleared Hollywood actress Rebel Wilson of defamation against Charlotte McInnes, the lead actor in her film The Deb, as you said. And so it pretty much brings to a close this ugly, messy, costly defamation battle.
Yeah, it has been pretty messy and so many headlines about this case. Can you give us a bit of a recap of what it was all about?
Yeah, so it was a pretty complex, I would say, defamation case. It was very, quite complicated. It was very high stakes, of course. It was making all the headlines, as you said. I was brought on by this young actress, Charlotte McInnes, who starred in The Deb. And this case revolves around a series of disparaging social media posts made by Rebel Wilson in 2024 and 2025. In them, Rebel Wilson alleged Charlotte McInnes made a sexual harassment complaint to her and then walked back those claims in order to further her career so she could have got like more acting jobs and a record deal. That was alleged in court. And so during 3 weeks of hearings in May, Rebel Wilson claims Ms. McInnes complained to her about feeling uncomfortable after sharing a bath with one of the film's producers, Amanda Ghost. Now, Ms. McInnes maintains she never made a complaint. Rebel Wilson later made a series of Instagram posts which Charlotte McInnes alleges portrayed her as a liar and a sellout. And so today the judge found that those meanings were not actually conveyed in those posts.
Yeah, and throughout this case, I mean, has Rebel Wilson had anything to say?
She wasn't there in court today. She lives in the US these days, but she did release a statement on Instagram and through her lawyers as well. I'll read you a bit of it. It says, "I'm grateful the court has taken the time to carefully consider the evidence and reach its decision. This has been a long process and throughout I have tried to stay grounded in my values and what I believe was right. I'm thankful for that process, has now reached its conclusion, adding right now what I'm focused on is what matters most, my family and my work."
What about Charlotte McInnes? Was she there in court?
She wasn't there in court, and her high-profile defamation lawyer, Sue Chrysanthu, she also wasn't there. We didn't see them in court or get any comment from them directly.
I mean, Rebel is a huge star, not just in Australia but around the world, obviously. Has there been a heap of Hollywood focus on this case, Lydia?
A lot of attention on this case from around the globe, of course, because, you know, Rebel Wilson is such a big star, an Australian star, but has made it huge, made it really big in Hollywood, Pitch Perfect, Bridesmaid, that kind of stuff. But also this film has also had a lot of legal issues with it. There is another court case going on in the US that's linked to this film as well, that's going on in the background as well. So a lot of people are watching, you know, this case as well as how things will pan out with the other cases. So,
for sure, yeah. For sure. Well, thank you so much for the update. ABC reporter Lydia Feng, really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Hack. The Iran war has cost the US some $37.5 billion so far, an increase of nearly $8 billion since May.
On Triple J.
How much do you think the war in Iran has cost the United States? Millions? Wrong. Billions. The equivalent of more than 50 billion Australian dollars in the past few months alone. This revelation made just a few days ago as fighting has been intensifying in the Middle East. Ariana Lucente has this update.
If you look at the damage that's been done, if we left today, it would take them decades to rebuild. And I don't believe they could ever rebuild. And honestly, they haven't seen anything yet.
The United States military has been striking Iran for 11 nights straight. And President Donald Trump is warning of a new target, Pickaxe Mountain.
Do you believe that Iran has moved nuclear centrifuges into Pickaxe Mountain? And when you say we're not done yet, what is left to finish?
Pickaxe Mountain, known in Iran as Kuah-e Kolan Khasla, is a significant site because buried about 100 metres inside the mountain is an underground nuclear facility. Located near Iran's already heavily damaged uranium enrichment facility in the city Natanz.
We follow the material, that's where the action is, and we'll be hitting that area pretty soon, and very heavily.
But wasn't there supposed to be a ceasefire? In early July, after Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps struck three commercial vessels, and the US carried out retaliatory strikes on Iranian targets, Trump declared the ceasefire over. Fighting in the region has escalated. Iran says it has launched attacks on US military bases across Kuwait, Bahrain, and Jordan. But those missiles were apparently intercepted and shot down. Kuwait says Iran is targeting civilian infrastructure like power and desalination plants. Here's Stefan Dujarric from the United Nations.
We've seen attacks on power plants and desalination plants in Kuwait and other places. Such attacks are unacceptable and must stop immediately.
Mediators in the region like Qatar, Egypt and Pakistan are now proposing a new 10-day ceasefire.
They want to desperately meet, and until they're ready to meet in a meaningful way, we have no interest.
With the aim of reopening oil shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. But the US and Iran haven't yet agreed. Esmail Bokoy is from Iran's foreign ministry.
Our diplomatic efforts have remained active, and a number of proposals and ideas from several mediators have indeed been communicated to us.
Over the weekend, Iranian strikes in Jordan killed two US soldiers. And the Houthis, Iran-backed militants in Yemen, have widened the conflict, saying they're now blocking ships from using Saudi Arabian ports in the Red Sea. Here's Yahya Sari from the Houthi military.
The criminal Saudi enemy continues its unjust and oppressive siege on our dear people for nearly 12 years. The situation has reached an unbearable level without any right or justification. This is something that cannot be accepted or tolerated.
Leading to concerns on how this could further impact the world's oil supply. Over in Washington, Trump has met with Lebanon's President Joseph Aoun at the White House. It was a pretty warm meeting, with Lebanon keen to get support from the US so the Lebanese armed forces can take over areas where Hezbollah has sway, but also to pressure Israel to continue withdrawing from southern Lebanon, which it has started. Here's the Lebanese president at the meeting.
Mr. President, this will be your legacy. Together, we'll be able to achieve this objective. It's about time for Lebanon and for the whole region to be stable and secure.
But in the US Senate, Pete Hegseth, US Defense Secretary, is getting grilled by a committee.
Do you have a new estimate about what the war has cost us so far in this, the fifth month of the first year of this war in Iran?
Senator, the estimate we have as of today is $37.5 billion.
With senators saying this war is now spiraling out of control.
You, sir, are the failure, not the men and women who are on that front line. You. You don't have a strategy. You don't have a long-term plan to actually win this war.
Hack on Triple J.
Ariana Lucente reporting there. Some messages coming through, people's opinions. Someone saying for Trump, there's no cost limit for personal distraction. Is that person's thoughts? Another person saying, no wonder the USA is finding it hard to afford their social services program. All right, we're going to move on.
Hack.
There's something about waking up for your own business compared to waking up to your 9-to-5 job. It just hits so differently.
On Triple J.
Yeah, how does being your own boss sound? Have you ever thought about starting your own business? Maybe you're thinking about it right now. After a horror day at work, in your head, you're going, could I do this? Could I go out by myself? How hard is it? Is it worth the risk? If you're doing it now, what is the best part and what is the worst part? 0439 757 555. Because in a second, you're going to hear from the group representing small businesses, who will tell you just how many young Australians are diving into this. The figures are a bit surprising, actually. But first, Evelyn Manfield's been chatting to some young owners and entrepreneurs.
Resigning from a job of stable income is really scary.
Last year, Jess Mann took a massive leap. She quit her job and opened up her own cafe.
Owning a cafe, it might sound a bit cliche, has been the only thing I've ever wanted to do.
After she landed on a name and sorted the branding, she found a spot by the beach in Adelaide and got demolishing. Pouring her savings into the business, she hired staff, installed a coffee machine and opened the doors.
You have to be willing to put everything on the line. I kind of took the approach that I'm 27, I don't have any dependents. Like, if there's ever time to take the risk, it's now. Every day, all I thought was, like, you can always earn the money back.
She's now 6 months in and loves it, but it certainly hasn't all been easy.
You have to wear all the hats. You're never just a manager. Something breaks, that is on you.
And she's only taking a relatively small wage. Most of the money flows straight back into the business.
Yeah, I'm definitely one of the younger people in the industry owning a business. I think people are quite nervous to take the leap, which is very understandable.
Another consideration is a lot of businesses fail. The Council of Small Businesses say less than half of businesses survive at least 3 years, with a quarter not even making it past year one. According to the last census, only 8% of people who were running a small business as their main job were under 30. But young people are working for themselves in other ways, like starting side hustles.
It's just one in five Gen Zs that are looking to be an employee only.
Sophie Renton is the managing director at research firm McCrindle. According to surveys they've done, Gen Z is more interested in self-employment or side hustles than older generations. That's to help get financially ahead or create something of their own. But she says some people find it's not the flexible lifestyle they dreamed of.
I often make the joke that they traded the 9-to-5 job to become an entrepreneur and now they work 24/7. So sometimes the reality of the small business life can come as a bit of a shock.
Up on the sunny coast in Queensland, Savannah Fowler has started her own business, and not without sacrifice.
I've pretty much sacrificed, like, the glory days of my whole entire, like, 20s because I'm working 12-hour days.
She's also risked a heap of her own money to get the business off the ground.
I do love it, so you kind of don't really see it as too much of a sacrifice, but when you look back, you realise how much time has gone and how much energy you have put into it.
Savannah's business is sewing quilted bags and laptop covers. It started as an operation from her spare bedroom, moved to the garage, and eventually into a warehouse. But she's still making the bags all by herself.
I would love to have some sewers working for me. I would love to have some project managers, some warehouse staff.
For businesses like Savannah's, a big part of attracting customers is drawing them in through social media.
They are quilted with the softest wadding. I've been running my handmade bag business for 3 years now and I still haven't gotten any better at packing orders. I want to show you guys my latest cream.
Which she says can be tough.
You have to kind of climb Cringe Mountain before you see like any reward.
And even though she's running her own business, there are still elements out of her control, like the US president imposing tariffs.
My customers can range between 17 to 25% US customers. It's like gone down to like 9% of my customer base. So that has huge impacts.
But for Jess Mann, having her own cafe is so rewarding.
It has made me the strongest version of myself.
And she hopes more young Aussies will give it a go.
I would love to see more young people take the leap in whatever industry it may be.
Hack on Triple J.
Evelyn Manfield reporting there and hearing from you on the text line. Someone says, I don't really have the self-discipline to run a small business. Another person saying, I had a gardening business. I loved the flexibility. I hated chasing money. Someone else saying that they had a laptop business, which is really interesting. We've got Matt on the line with us from Melbourne. Matt, you have your own business. What do you do?
Yeah, I do. I've got a custom furniture business where we design and make furniture, but we also run some woodworking classes as well.
Okay, and how's that been? Like, pros, cons?
I'd say massive hours, definitely to get it off the ground, taking home not as much wage as what you want to for a very long time. But also I would agree with what people have said about trying to keep up with just doing social media and wearing all the hats. And it can be a grind to put a lot of social videos out there and not always get traction for the amount of work that you're putting in.
Yeah, I imagine. Do you regret it at all, Matt?
I don't regret it because I think I always would look back and wish that I had started doing what I did. I know I'm good at what I do because I'd like designing and making custom pieces, and I couldn't do that in any other role. So I guess I'm proud of what I built, but yeah. It is tricky when you sort of think, you know, am I falling behind with other people who are just in a stable job where they're making good money consistently?
Yeah, fair point. But it is a really creative line of work you're in, and not everyone can do it. So hats off to you. Really brave thing to start your own business. Thank you so much for speaking with us, Matt. I want to open this discussion a little more now, and with us is Sky Capuccio, who's the CEO of the Council of Small Business Organisations Australia. G'day, Sky. Thank you so much for coming on.
Hi, Dave. Nice to be joining you.
Do you think we're seeing enough young people crack into their own small businesses?
Look, unfortunately, we've seen over the last 50 years or so quite a dramatic drop in the number of small businesses and the number of young people, the number of people under 30 who are becoming small business owners. So at the moment, there's about 8% of small business owners in Australia who are under 30. Back in the mid-70s, that was closer to 20%. And part of the challenge is that we have an aging small business owner cohort, quite a significant number of small business owners, around a third, who plan to retire in the next 5 years. And we just don't have the numbers of young people coming through who are excited about going into business to replace them.
Right. So we're seeing this retirement cliff, essentially, of boomers leaving the workforce, leaving their businesses, and could be left in a bit of a tricky situation. I mean, what's that going to mean for Australia?
Look, I think small business is a really important part of Australia's economy. It makes up about a third collectively. Small businesses in Australia, of which there are about 2.7 million, make up about a third of our GDP. So they're important to productivity. They collectively employ over 5 million people. So they're important to jobs. But they're also a really important part of our community. You know, the cafe I go across the road each day to get my coffee, where they know my name, they know my coffee order without me having to say anything, is a really important part of my community experience. And you amplify that across every street and every town in Australia. It's an important part of everyone's community experience. So it's a really strong case to be supporting and fostering small business.
It's really interesting, the stats you mentioned before about how many young people are getting into small businesses, and it is a small proportion of the population, especially when you consider it, when you compare it, with other parts of the world, particularly parts of Asia, where people are getting into businesses quite young. It's not an older demographic. Are lots of people trying and then it's not working? They're having to get out?
I think there's some things that make stepping into small business seem hard. One of the things we really commonly hear from younger people looking at going into small business ownership is challenges with accessing finance. So most lending in Australia is still collateral based, which means that banks want property or other assets as security. And young people who are far less likely to own a home, and obviously we are seeing lots of challenges with home ownership, and they're far less likely to have built equity. They simply don't have that collateral to offer. So no matter how good their business idea is, it can often be harder to access the finance. The other big one we hear from young people is the deterrent of red tape. So a good example is just to open a cafe in Victoria. Before you can even pour your first cup of coffee, you need to navigate around 37 separate licenses and approvals. So it's quite a significant burden and can create a significant barrier to people stepping into the small business space.
Do you think it's also like a work-life balance thing, in the sense that owning a small business would be challenging at many times because, yes, you have a bit of freedom and you get to chart your own course, but also you might be looking out for staff, you might not be able to clock off as you would in a normal Monday to Friday job.
I definitely think that that is part of it. And small business and being a small business owner really does require a significant commitment. But having said that, young people are still innovators. They're still entrepreneurs. They still want to chase an idea and build something of their own. So I'm not sure it's so much about the appetite to become a business owner and to become your own boss that's changed, so much of the size of the barriers that are in front of younger people these days.
Really interesting. This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Sky Capuccio, who's head of the Council of Small Business Organisations Australia. Hearing from a lot of you on the text line now, someone saying, I've got a small business. The biggest lesson for me was the part of the cost of doing the business was part of the cost of doing business, is chasing the customers for payment. You think you've done the job and sent the invoice, but customers don't always pay, and chasing the money is a full-time job in itself. Interesting. Another person saying young people would be far more excited about opening a small business if there was any support at all from governments for small business. And someone else saying, I love it, but it is a constant state of stress and anxiety. No such thing as finishing for the day and mentally clocking off. We've actually got Kathleen on the line with us. Kathleen, you have your own cleaning business in a regional area. What's that like?
So far, so good. I've been really lucky to start up where I have. The community has really gotten involved and they've definitely supported me. But yeah, I'm still under the 2-year mark. So it is still very fresh. But yeah, so far, so good.
How are you finding the work-life balance? Like, are you still managing a bit of time for yourself?
Yeah, I am, but only quite recently. I think that thing you said earlier about finding staff, that's super hard. But I've been really lucky, and I guess just trying to treat them really well and pay them well. And hold on to them, so I still do get that work-life balance.
Interesting. Thank you so much, Kathleen. Really appreciate chatting to you. We've also got Monica, who's another cleaner. Monica, how's your cleaning business?
It's thriving.
Good to hear. Well, please don't mention the brand because we're not allowed to say it on Triple J or the ABC, unfortunately. But good to hear that it's thriving for you. So you don't regret opening your own business?
No way. Like, I'm 38 now. I did it 2 years ago and I wish I had done it sooner.
Oh, wow. Okay, Monica, love to hear that. And so many other people with other good news stories, which is great to hear. Let's go back to Sky Capuccio from the Council of Small Business Organisations. Sky, what do you think needs to change to encourage more people to get into this world?
So I think in a broader sense, we really need to look at the economic conditions we have in the country and what we are doing in a broad range of spaces to drive productivity and make small business seem like a great and viable option to get into. I also think one of the really practical things we could do is cutting the red tape that makes starting up a business and running a business harder than it needs to be. Red tape matters, regulation is important, but we also have a lot of unnecessary and duplicative red tape that isn't adding value. We also, I think, need to be looking at how we support access to finance. So we need our lending approaches to be responsible, but we need to balance that against the need and the opportunity to support people who want to innovate and to step into business.
Interesting stuff. Sky Capuccio from the Council of Small Business Organisations. Really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And some more messages. Someone saying, I've been in small business for years. It's something I would definitely encourage other young people to think about, but it is really hard. Someone else saying, older professionals need to be more willing to pass on the torch. Empower your employees to take that step if they want to. And another person saying, my business turned 10 this year. I could not be prouder of the blood, sweat and tears that I've poured into it. All right, we're going to move on.
Hack. Next Monday, an emergency siren will sound on every switched-on phone in Australia.
On Triple J. Yeah, not sure if you've heard about this, but Monday, a 10-second alarm is going to go off on phones right across Australia. Doesn't matter if you're on Do Not Disturb, it doesn't matter where you are. It's called AusAlert. And people have a lot of questions about what this is, why we're doing it, how it's going to work. So here to answer some of those is Paula Dootson, who's an Associate Professor in Business and Law at Queensland University of Technology. G'day, Paula. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What is this AusAlert test? What can people expect?
People can expect to receive a message on their phone and, like you said, a loud siren that will go for about 10 seconds. And the message will say, this is a test of the new National Emergency Warning System. And it won't ask you to do anything. It's just testing whether or not that device can actually be reached.
So why is it happening?
So it was a consequence of a recent Royal Commission into natural hazards that we experience here in Australia. And there was a call for a national system that could alert people early about a threat and that everyone would get access to it. So we've seen it being applied to natural hazards, but the government may also use it for health incidents, national security incidents, or like biohazard incidents as well.
Do we have any clear idea about when this is all going to be rolled out?
It's going live in October, which is why the community testing is so important, because we have a bushfire season coming up, and if it needs to be used then, it's great to test it and its capability before we actually hit a real event.
Okay. I mean, I've seen some concerns, Paula, around at-risk groups being able to access and use the info that comes from these alerts. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
Absolutely. So it is going to hopefully reach that NEMA is estimating 90% of devices across Australia, but there are definitely older devices that are not going to receive this message. And if you want to check your phone or device's compatibility, please check the AusAlert website. But there's also the possibility of people who maybe don't read English, they're not going to be able to access the message because it's only going to be released in English in this first iteration. And there are also challenges around if you don't have a device, then you won't be receiving this message.
You're listening to Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Paula Dootson, who's an associate professor at QUT, and we're talking about this AusAlert test that's going to happen next week and what you can expect from it, why we're doing it. Paula, this is the international standard, right? Do we know how these kinds of systems work in other countries?
Absolutely. So it's a very common system. Over 30 countries have this functioning already and have had it functioning for a while. And what we've learned from overseas is the value in the content that goes in that message. So during a real event, there are 7 key things that absolutely have to be in the message so people can actually respond and take protective action. They need to know who that message is coming from, what actually is the hazard, where is the hazard, what any timing information of when it's going to impact, what does that impact look like, what should we do about it, and then where can we find further info. So having that means we can have the best possible chance at saving lives in these high-risk situations.
I mean, with any technology, there's always a concern that, you know, things can go wrong. There could be some teething issues with rolling out a new system. Is that a concern for, you know, authorities as well?
It's a concern for any new technology, frankly, and that's why we've seen the localized testing happen back in June, the national tests that will happen now. And again, because we are not the first to do this, we can look to other countries and see where they've had issues before. For example, if somebody got a warning but they're not actually at threat, that's a problem. It can make people lose trust in the system because they'll look around and say, no, I'm not actually at threat of a fire right now. So things like that will determine how effective the platform is moving forward in real events.
So just confirming, people don't have to do anything when this happens next week.
Correct. Everyone will just hear a noise, and it will probably be quite confusing to a lot of people who didn't know what was happening. And we will just go about our lives after those 10 seconds are over.
That's a great update. A lot of questions have been asked about this. I've been seeing some headlines about it for a few weeks, actually, and there are some explainers online too if people want to learn a bit more about this and what is planned. But for now, Associate Professor Paula Dootson from QUT, really appreciate you coming on and having a bit of a chat with us about it.
Thank you. Good luck, everyone, on Monday.
And we've got a lot of messages still coming through about small businesses. I'm so stoked to read that there are so many small business owners in the Hack audience. Someone's saying, look, I can't believe there's been a drop in small businesses. All I see is thousands of OnlyFans pages and people selling farts in a jar. Are they not declaring that? That person says, yes, all businesses. No shame around businesses at all. Another person saying, I think it would be so fun to have a small business, but it looks so expensive. And also, when I drive down the streets in Melbourne, it seems like every second place is shutting down. So why bother? Which is an interesting point that I put to the Council of Small Businesses about us seeing fewer physical shops, but then there are all of these online opportunities as well, that they're saying you're giving people a bit of an opportunity to taste what it's like to have a small business without maybe investing so much money. Someone else saying, I'm 33, I've been an electrical contractor for 6 years, taxation needs reform, which is another big thing that we've been hearing on the text line. Someone else saying, yeah, it was the tax on businesses that ruined me and made me call it quits. And someone else saying, as a freelancer in the arts, I was unexpectedly out of work during COVID. I started my own online dog treat business with my mum. It was a great way to get into something new. All right, that is all we've got time for on Hack for now.